Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Time is such an elusive concept. It just passes by like the will of a wisp. And I cannot believe it's been nearly 2 years since we last had the awesome gothic duo and indeed horror duo of Kelly Florence and Meg Hafdahl on the production. But welcome back, folks. It's delightful to actually see you again. And we also have a equally talented author with us as well for this panel that's going to discuss women in horror and begin to actually outline that. That's Monica Kubler. How are you, Monica?
I'm great, thank you.
Excellent. Monica, we'll start with you as making the debut. Share with us kind of your own interests in gothic horror, or indeed in horror per se, shall we say, and how you particularly sort of followed this particular genre of fiction as an ace writer.
Well, actually, I'm a horror journalist, and I've been working with Rue Morgue magazine out of Toronto, Canada, for more than 20 years, covering horror literature of all shapes and sizes and styles, gothic and otherwise. I also write my own YA fiction, so I kind of see it from all sides.
Indeed. And speaking of that, you can't get much better than being Bram Stoker nominated, which of course is what we can congratulate both Meg and Kelly on from that point of view. Again, we'll turn to you now, if we may, Meg, just a brief descriptor in terms of obviously the fabulous work that you actually have put together, etc. I mean, Daughters of Darkness, of course, being there, particularly like the review, every bit as page-turning as any Stephen King novel. So again, what drew you into the horror genre, Meg?
You know, that's a good question. I think a lot of people look at me and they're like, "Oh, you're such a nice girl. Why horror?" I think that you know, there's something about the psychological aspect of horror and taking a character and throwing them into the worst day of their life and seeing if they sink or swim, seeing if they really can sort of vanquish the monster, the actual literal monster, and then oftentimes the sort of conflict, the inner conflict that they have going on in their life at the same time. And I love that juxtaposition. And I just love being scared. I can't help it. I've just always wanted to watch scary movies and read scary books. So it's just a natural thing for me that I've always been magnetized toward.
Of course, you do have a connection with Kelly Florence, our other guest. Kelly, similar question, just to set the scene, really. How did it pan out for your good self that you said, well, it was good enough for Mary Shelley back in the day, so it should be good enough for me in the 21st century?
Yes, it should have been a sign that, like, one of my first crushes was Frankenstein's monster, and I loved King Kong, so I was drawn to the Bad Boys. But really, it's all about that feeling of being scared, but in a safe environment. It's Bigfoot really isn't going to come and take me away at night, even though I was like,
I don't know, Donald Trump is up for the presidency. Who knows what could happen?
Well, that's true.
I mean, again, an interesting and fascinating sort of initial sort of line there. Let's dig a little bit deeper. And Monica, we'll come to you if we may. Horror often emerges as a horror cycle. We see these time and time again, certainly over the last 200 years, that in times of social stress, in times where people actually wish to have, as indeed I think Meg and Kelly alluded to there, the kind of the safe scare, the cathartic release, etc., we see horror emerging. We've had obviously the stalk and slash genre. We've got gothic horror that constantly reemerges. We have the picket fence is almost David Lynchian approach of horror, Stephen King, other writers, etc., and the more psychological horror. What for you kind of fits in terms of the cultural aspect of horror? And indeed, is it something which is going to be forever connected with respect to how we view ourselves as human beings?
I think so, 100%. And I mean, I think we see these rises of horror when things are tough out there in the world, because through the genre is how we explore those fears. We shine the spotlight onto them. We can use monsters in so many ways that you couldn't use, like, you know, a human character. With a monster, you can do so much more. You can push some really tough stuff right up into people's faces. If you're, you know, having the monster do the monstrous, it allows us to investigate our humanity. It allows us to investigate our fears and traumas. And in a lot of ways, it allows us to question them and even work through them. I mean, there's a lot of conversation out there about how, for a lot of folks, who've experienced violence, they find horror cathartic because it allows them to, revisit things, but in a safe, as you said, contained kind of way.
Meg, the attempts to actually define genres is one which has vexed fandom of all generations across the years. Is it fantasy? Is it horror fantasy? Is it hybridization? Is it science fiction? Following this interview, we're actually going to be talking with a sound engineer from Australia and her collaborator, Alan Stevens, in terms of how their recent work could be classified as both horrific and science fiction. How would you define the material that you write and produce within the horror genre?
Yeah, I think that I actually just before I hopped on here, I saw an article. Somebody was going on. This is a something that happens every few years. Somebody says Silence of the Lambs is not horror, and somebody was obviously rebuttal. There was a rebuttal of that. For me, I'm a big fan of. You mentioned Mary Shelley, and obviously what Monica was saying. What's happening in the world. We're sort of bringing to light within, the what's happening in the era, and Mary Shelley was bringing to light in the Industrial Revolution of, should just because we can, should we? And she was also talking about the female experience, and I have been fascinated, since I read Mary Shelley, since I read Charlotte Perkins Gilman, the female experience and how to sort of push that through horror and the monstrous. So for me, I really love talking about motherhood, being a wife, being a woman. And so for me, I very much talk about the female gothic. And so that is sort of my genre within horror. But I am a big believer in like smashing it all together. And I love romance and comedy and all sci-fi and all that in horror. And I think horror is such a bigger thing than a lot of people think slasher equals horror. I find so many people who think an 80s slasher is a horror and that's it. They have a very narrow view of what horror is. So I love that people are out there saying, yes, Silence of the Lambs is horror. And I can't believe we still have to have that conversation.
It's the age-old debate about is Harry Potter science fiction? After all, according to Arthur C. Clarke, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, so therefore Hogwarts could well be hardcore SF, but that's another aside.
There you go.
Ke Kelly, from your own perspective, would you echo what Meg's just been saying in terms of really attempting to coalesce your own writing around the genre of horror?
Something that we've discovered in our nonfiction books, the Science of series, we've found all of these true things that have happened that horror is based on. And I think that that's the most fascinating part of the genre is that it's not just, I'm going to think of something wild. A lot of times it comes from that nugget of truth, whether it be a woman's experience, whether it be a medical condition that someone heard about, or a true crime that happened. All of these things, it's plausible because it is based on a nugget of truth.
Monica, from your own perspective within the magazine sort of world, I mean, somebody her I was particularly impressed with in terms of her work on the series Buffy the Vampire Slayer was Jane Espenson. I think she actually managed to give a very solid voice to the characters and probably actually added to the whole sort of genre and Joss Whedon's work excessively. Who has influenced you with respect to women writers of horror in particular? I mean, obviously, apart from Kelly and Meg, who obviously go without saying that they're very much at the top of the field.
Well, I think this is going to date me, but I think my earliest and probably most pivotal influence was Anne Rice because she was the biggest female horror author at the time that I was growing up. And she was, in this world of like Stephen King's and Clive Barker's and Dean R. Kuntz, she was like doing this, these amazing things with these vampire books. And she kind of made me realize, you can be a woman and you can have a voice in this world. Because back in the 80s, when I was young, there was, horror was still, a bit of a boys' club back then. So I think for me personally, she kind of opened that mental door in my head that said, you know what? If you want to write spooky stuff or you want to write about spooky stuff, it's okay. There's a way in. So she would be my number one, definitely from like early in my career.
And certainly, Anne Rice paved the way for many sort of areas. I would almost say that you could always draw a parallel between Anne Rice for the horror genre and arguably Ursula K. Le Guin or Anne McCaffrey for the science fiction genre in terms of, again, contemporary area. Although, as we said, in many ways, it's often forgotten that it was Mary Shelley who kicked the whole thing off, arguably at least as far as contemporary SF is concerned. What about yourself, Kelly, in terms of influences? I mean, Anne Rice very much there. Is it also a case of, yeah, with that interview with a vampire, frankly, my life would not have been the same.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up reading Stephen King, probably too young, but Anne Rice was definitely in the mix. V.C. Andrews, all of these really scary concepts that, again, maybe a elementary or middle schooler shouldn't have been reading, but I was fascinated by it and learning that all of these women have written about these incredible stories. And that we could too. It was awe-inspiring. It wasn't just for the boys.
And Meg, anything to add?
Shirley Jackson. I didn't find Shirley Jackson until I was older. Unfortunately, I wasn't introduced to her until I was in college, but I aspire to have her subtlety. I feel like if I could write with the subtle dread that she writes with, that would be my dream. She's able to write horror with such, like, I'm a gore girl. I love gore. I can't help it. But she does it without gore and still scares the pants off of you. Like, that's a master.
All three of you are based in North America. You're based, say, in that particular area. We've just obviously had the Academy Awards. Killers of the Flower Moon didn't quite do as well as I had hoped it was going to do. I feel it was a wonderful movie. In a sense, a kind of real life horror. But my question really is in terms of looking at native voices, Native American voices, etc., has that proved to be influential at all in your writing? Are there areas which you like to explore to discuss with Native original native voices to say what horrific stories they were, because sitting around a campfire, of course, with the shaman and the whole notion of that, there are a whole range of areas and archetypes which you don't have to do a kind of Jungian analysis to actually see. Yeah, you see certain archetypes coming out when it comes to the horror story, etc. Monica, any thoughts from yourself initially?
Not in my own writing, but it is something I love to investigate in the magazine. I love to investigate horror stories from all over the world and from all different folklores and, kind of the monsters and superstitions. I think it's been really amazing in the last few years that so many more diverse works have been getting published. But as far as my own work, I tend to write what I know, and my husband is part native, but I don't feel like that's my place to go as a white woman. So I prefer to amplify those voices than to borrow from their folklore or, their traditional beliefs. There's a lot of stuff I can borrow from in my own Euro background to toss into my work. I think a lot of times, those stories should in fact be told by the cultures that they have come out
Certainly, cultural appropriation could take us off into a whole new area, which
of.
I think will be another whole sort of set of interviews. But Kelly, what about yourself? Again, the point that Monica made there about diversity and range of voices, etc. Is that something which you find exciting? Is it a case of, yes, it is important, or is it a case of, no, this should be done solely by white females writing about their own experience?
No, we absolutely uplift and celebrate diverse voices. One of our good friends, Shane Hawk, his anthology, Never Whistle at Night, is on the New York Times bestselling list for weeks and weeks now, and we couldn't be happier for him. In our books, we made sure when we were talking about indigenous history and lore that we interviewed indigenous women. We interviewed an ethnobotanist who's indigenous based in North Dakota about the view of magical healing and really how it's nature based and that science has always been all around us. We just didn't have names for it. And so that was really eye opening.
Yeah, and I have to say I'm a huge Stephen Graham Jones fan, and he's a huge voice in horror right now for the Indigenous community, and it's just exciting to see people from all different backgrounds really exploring horror, because I think particularly people of color and women and people who have been in marginalized communities. Horror makes sense to them because there's, if you watch a Jordan Peele movie, for example, there's something about horror that translates experiences that they've had as a community that a drama or something doesn't necessarily do. So I think that horror is just such a great outlet for everyone on the planet.
You mentioned Jordan Peele, of course, who made a brave effort, I think, to actually update the Twilight Zone series recently,
Yeah.
and actually did some interesting takes on that. Let's talk Women in Horror Month, of course, because I mean there is a notion saying it should be Women in Horror Decade, not just Women in Horror Month, let alone the whole system on that. Do you think is it more than a marketing ploy? Is it a celebration? How do you see it, Monica, in terms of as a brand itself?
Well, I think it just gives everyone an excuse to scream about female horror authors on their social media for a month. It gives an excuse for people to publish lists of books you should have read and you might not have read. And it gives a chance to celebrate things that, might have gotten missed. And we've gotten a lot better about, inclusivity in anthologies and whatnot over the last 5, 10 years. You're not only you're not no no excuse me. You're now no longer seeing like a list of contributors that's all men with like one or two or three token women. It's much more balanced now. But I think that any, excuse to shout about work that hasn't traditionally been shouted about and, might encourage readers who typically, claim to enjoy male voices more in their fear fiction to try something new, try something different. I think that can only be good for the whole genre going forward, because the more voices we have from the more, different genders, different disparate backgrounds, that's going to make our genre more vital, and it's going to make our genre thrive much longer than if we're telling the same stories about serial killers and haunted houses and North American experiences over and over and over again.
Meg, anything to add?
Yeah, I think, like Monica said, it's what a great excuse to just amplify, a community that doesn't always get a lot of attention. I mean, I love Stephen King. I love Clive Barker. I love a lot of great, wonderful. I just said Stephen Graham Jones is wonderful. But this is another great opportunity, or one great opportunity, for us to talk about wonderful female or non-binary authors that we don't normally get to shout about from the rooftops. And something too is to just talk about the ones that we normally don't talk about either. Like we talk about Anne Rice, we talk about Shirley Jackson, but there are so many wonderful female authors. Tanana Reeve Dhu recently had a book come out. Oh gosh, Gwendolyn Christie, Keist, I'm sorry, just had a book come out. So there's just so many wonderful female authors. I could just provide a whole list, but that's what we want to do this month, is we want to, a blog about it and put it on Instagram, put it on X and all those things. So what a great opportunity to do that.
And many people would actually say that X in itself is a horrific case in terms of how not to use social media, but that's for another tale at another time. Kelly, anything else you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, I'm throwing my voice out there for women directors and writers and showrunners on TV and film, because they have been making amazing movies, short films, feature films, TV shows for decades, and we don't always necessarily hear about them. We just loved this season of True Detective, run by Issa Lopez, and her very horrific take on that story. And so Shout out to all the women in that genre as well, or that field.
It seems a bit crass to actually move back to a male author after celebrating a lot of women authors, but I do want to bring this character up because he does tend to polarize people. H.P. Lovecraft and the Call of Cthulhu and the kind of the weird aspects of horror. Any thoughts on that one, Kelly, to start off with this time?
Yeah, I know he's problematic, but we were just in this past year in Providence, Rhode Island, and saw a lot of H.P. Lovecraft things, and there's a walking tour. Those stories were terrifying to me. Now I can look at them through, a more educated lens and know what was wrong with his, views, but very scary. I love a good creature.
I mean that whole creature feature scenario, obviously much beloved by a whole range of horror movies, etc. Meg, your thoughts on Lovecraftian horror?
Yeah, I mean, I always say like I feel like you're either kind of a Poe girl or you're a Lovecraft girl. I'm always going to be more of a Poe girl, but I do have a special place for Lovecraft. Again, I acknowledge that he's problematic. But Kelly and I have a travel book coming out where we go around the country and we went to Providence and we did some research on Lovecraft and went around to some of his places that he lived, et cetera. And it was quite cool. And Providence is very proud of their hometown boy. So it was quite neat.
And does the call of Cthulhu call to you, Monica? Or is it a case of no, frankly, I'd prefer to actually go down the Edgar Allan Poe route like Meg?
Personally, I also am more of a Poe girl, but I recognize the importance of Lovecraft. Even with like the problematic elements aside, a lot of people back then were creating and they were problematic. But one only needs to look at how much his work has ex inspired over the years. People are still writing in the Lovecraftian mythos to this day and being successful at it and subverting it and making it more female friendly. So we absolutely can't discount the importance that he has to the genre. And I don't think, it's the correct thing to do to scrub history of people who are problematic. I think the correct way to address this is, the way that Disney has addressed it in front of some of their feature films on the Disney Channel, which is to say, there are elements in here that from a historical, place are now problematic. But it is important to understand where we came from and some of the nasty things in our past so that we don't repeat them again in the future. So I'm definitely not of the camp of we should get rid of Lovecraft altogether, but I do it made me nerve I understood the whole thing when they changed the statuette that was like a Lovecraft bust to at that one awards to something else because yeah, it is a bit problematic giving a Lovecraft bu bust to a writer of color. Knowing what Lovecraft's views were. So I think, we have to engage with his legacy and with his work from a place of intelligence and a place of understanding that, yes, there are things to be talked about that are, weren't really acceptable then and are definitely not acceptable now, but like the body of work was so influential that we have to recognize it for that as well.
So I can almost hear the cheers coming from a number of writers who would actually echo that point as made by the historian Santayana, that if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat its mistakes. So I think important from that perspective. You could argue, of course, China Mieville, a contemporary writer, has been much influenced in some of his writings. Embassy Town, of course, contains a lot of kind of quite interesting, almost Lovecraftian aliens. In terms of the difficulties of understanding and so on, but let's move back to women in horror, if we may. And this is a kind of standard question again for the three of you. Advice for young writers, something which is regularly mooted at a whole range of conventions at circuits and things from that point of view. Other than, of course, the very basic premise, well, if you're a writer, you need to write. Anything that you'd actually say would be important for, shall we say, a young Kelly Florence, a young Meg Haftel, a young Monica Kubler to actually sort of say, okay, what should you bear in mind now we're into the second quarter almost of the 21st century?
For me, I think if I could go back and tell little Kelly Florence what to do, is not, don't be afraid to just write and not over edit yourself in the beginning. to get it out on the page and then get some feedback. And it's okay, it's not going to be perfect the first time or the second, but I think what stops a lot of people is that fear of it's not good enough. I have to be, it has to be perfect before someone else lays eyes on it. So I would just say, just go for it and write.
Meg?
I think for me, my personal thing was that I wanted to write the next great American novel, and so I was like, I'm not going to be a genre writer. And I was not successful and happy until I just accepted that I'm a horror writer. So I would say, write what you love. If you're a romance reader, then you're a romance writer. I was a horror reader, so I'm a horror writer. You can bring in wonderful, profound meaning into a horror novel, and you can bring wonderful, profound meaning into a romance or fantasy. You don't have to, write an esoteric, dramatic novel and that make you feel important. You can write the genre that you love to read. Just do what makes you happy.
I often think the crossing over of westerns and horror could be well developed. Jonah Hex, I think,
All
was a
right.
comic character that kind of did that side of things. But anyway, Monica, what about your advice scenario?
Tell the stories that you want to tell that are important to you. Tell them in the way that you want to tell them that speak to you. Don't worry about chasing trends. Don't worry about mashing genres together. Don't worry about all the rules. At the center of the story is its heart. Worry about the heart. Worry about telling the story in the truest form that you can tell it. Write for yourself before you write for others, I guess, is what I'm coming to. That story should move you before it's going to move anybody else. So don't just tr chase trends.
Kind of goes back to the words of the Oracle at Delphi, really, to thine own self be true, basically. If you can't actually sort of echo that, then maybe there is a challenge. Just to prevent confusion, because I know we had this over Black History Month, because in Britain, Black History Month is in October. Obviously, in the USA, it's in February. In terms of Women in Horror Month, is this a global celebration, or do we find that if we go to Tanzania, they'll be celebrating Women in Horror Month maybe in June or July?
It used to be in February, Women in Horror Month, and then it was moved to March. And so I'm not, I think it was a couple years ago that it was changed. I'm not sure if it's universally everywhere this month. Ladies, do you know?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose with respect to, as we said at the start of the piece, time zones and various other bits and pieces, it's irrelevant in any case. But and cosmologists would say that everything is happening all at once at the same time.
There you go.
So it doesn't really matter. But it was just I was trying to clarify the issue on that basis. Okay, let's move on to what 2024 has in store for yourself, Monica. What kind of exciting projects are you looking to do, or is it just a case of, well, each day is a challenge?
No, that was 2023. 2024, I'm getting back to my writing desk. I have a online YA serial that I'm on the fourth and final book, and I'm about halfway through, and I really need to finish that. So that is up first for me. I've got a couple other things that I outlined last year when I wasn't able to do a lot of writing, and of course, continuing to investigate horror through the magazine and celebrate amazing books and amazing authors. So kind of staying in line with what I've been doing all these years.
Okay, Kelly.
So Meg and I have two books coming out this year, The Science of Alfred Hitchcock, speaking of problematic men. And we're also our
I'm sure
travel
Grace
book.
Kelly found him perfectly happy to work with.
Yeah.
Yeah, no problems whatsoever. But Janet Lee, not a difficulty at all. All just
Yeah.
yeah.
We address that in the book, so don't worry, readers. And then our travel book, Travels of Terror. We travel to 12 cities across the United States and investigate spooky places, horror-themed things, and we always highlight a woman you should know.
And Meg,
Yes.
presumably being co-author with her, that's part of you said, well, it's already been said, or
Yes.
anything else you'd like to add?
And I also have a story coming out in an anthology in May called Mother Knows Best. It's a horror anthology about scary mothers. So my story is called Special Medicine.
One element that is frequently said to scare writers or concern writers is, of course, ChatGPT. artificial intelligence, and it's a topic I was going to save until the end because I thought we'll have a nice little scary part at the end in terms of the AI will emerge, etc. Lots of things have happened since we last spoke, of course, Kelly and Meg, in 2022, in terms of how AI has permeated the world and so on. Are you concerned? Are you happy to embrace it? Have you looked at the sort of material that's being produced? I can actually confirm, as I frequently do at interviews these days, that as far as I'm aware, all four of us are indeed real live human beings, and we haven't actually been replaced by avatars or indeed chat bots as yet. But in my case, I never know these days, so my students often say, whatever. Kelly, let's take you first. I mean, any thoughts on the future with technology in mind?
I'm not a fan. As a teacher, at a college level, I see that some students are, trying to get away with having AI-generated papers. And an interesting thing that a lot of colleagues have started doing is, okay, you have the AI write your paper, and then you have to correct it and point out what's wrong with it. And it's brought to light, of course, students thinking, seeing it in a new way. And so I really want things that I read, whether it be fiction or nonfiction, creative things to be made by humans. And I understand that we have to embrace technology, and there's probably a place for it, but not in what I want to read.
Meg?
I have maybe this is like a overly Pollyanna view, but I have faith in humans that we support creativity and support humans, and that we want to read and watch movies and see art that other humans make. And I think that I could just really get scared of AI and feel like it's going to take my job. But I'm just going to have faith in humanity that people want to read books by real human beings.
Well, that's a pleasingly optimistic view, although arguably Pollyanna itself had a few horrific moments in it, basically, especially when portrayed by Hayley Mills on screen. I think I'm still
Oh,
traumatized by
yeah.
a sort of ill sequence, but still. Monica, your own thoughts as a magazine journalist as well?
I don't like AI in creative spaces. I do think there's a place for it. I use some wonderful AI scheduling software that tells me what I should do each day, which is fantastic. That's brain power I don't need to use anymore. I think there's some great scientific and medical applications for it, but I don't like seeing it in the writing space. And I don't, at the same time, I don't think, like, I look at my own writing and I write, so much in my books is about like human trauma and things humans go through. And I don't think AI is ever going to be able to mimic the emotions of that or the experience of that, because it's only like what's it's grabbed from other writers. It's not, it can't, it doesn't have these experiences itself. It's just an amalgamation of stuff it's scraped off the web. So I don't think that AI written things are ever going to have the emotional core that things that are written by living, breathing humans will, because living, breathing humans have the experience. A computer can only render an approximation of that based on whatever it's churned into itself. So, but I do worry about it in the magazine landscape, because when new writers come at me, there's always a, oh, okay, are they writing this themselves, or are they doing it with AI? How do you figure it out? Are there tells as AI gets better and better? You worry that some of that stuff might slip through before you can catch it and say no, or that people aren't going to represent themselves authentically. They'll say they wrote it and really they didn't. So on a professional level, it concerns me because, there's obviously potential legal liabilities and stuff there if the writers aren't generating the content themselves. And there's lots of chance for errors to be introduced if they're not doing their own research and fact checking properly and are just asking questions into like an AI to get answers.
I couldn't help but think, as you were saying, about the gathering together of different sources without the human spark to create something. Of wasn't that where Mary Shelley started with the whole Frankenstein monster in the first place? But that's another issue for another time, which I'm sure would be fascinating. It's been awesome connecting with your good selves. Coming up next, we've got Australian sound designer Chrissy Pashley sharing her thoughts in terms of how she was working with Alan Stevens to create, again, a horrific science fiction take on a story that they've been working on. So that's to come next. But for the moment, to Kelly Florence, to Meg Halfdahl, to Monica Kubler, huge thanks. It's been great. Let's not leave it another 2 years before we get together. Let's hopefully see you again very soon. Take care now.
Thank
Sounds good.
you.
Thanks for having
Thank you for
us.
having me.
It's time. Time for what, you might well say? Well, time for another adventure from Caldor City. Yes, the Caldor City that I have also been using with some of our media production students to provide evidence of how good quality audio can be developed and used and enhanced for all sorts of wonderful, entertaining audio experiences. We've got not one, but two fabulous co-producers from Caldor City with us. Indeed, one of them is the co-founder of the whole system. First of all, Alan Stevens. How are you, Alan?
I'm thanks. Tongue-tied a bit, I'm afraid, but I'm fine, thanks, Alex.
That's okay.
It's a bit of a tongue twister, isn't it? Fine, I'm fine. Oh, whatever. Okay.
Don't go there. But also in Australia, the legendary sound designer, sound landscape creator, audio person extraordinaire, Chrissy Pashley. How are you, Chrissy?
Good, thank you. Nice to see you. Oh, nice to hear from you again.
Yeah, in this particular instance, I'll just let the listener know, I can see Chrissy, she can't see me. She can't see Alan either, but there we are. That's part and parcel of the whole thing. Okay, Alan, share with us, what is this recent release all about? And, of course, how does it connect with a wonderful person called David?
Well, the new story is called Prelude. It's currently available on the Caldor City website as a free-to-download audio. It's written by David Tully. Brian Croucher has an appearance in it. It's about Travis. Committing a massacre on a planet. I think it's the planet Oros. I don't want to spoil it, but it's considering what's been happening in the news recently, it's quite pertinent and relevant, I feel.
Now, Chrissy, we obviously explored with yourself how you got involved with Magic Bullet Productions, how you're more than just an aficionado of Blake 7 and the diegetic worlds that emerge within that. Just share with us how you're feeling about this latest production. Is it a case of you're just raising the bar again and again?
Well, I mean, I like to think so. That'd be nice if I was. And I think... I actually made this story before the others because I made them in the order that they were on the website originally, I think. And so I started at the beginning on this one, and this was the first story. So I had made this one before I made Gothic and Premature Burial and the other ones we've spoken about. So I went back and listened to it again after we'd finished the last one. And when I listened through again, I thought, oh, my God, that's terrifying. You know, it was really impacting on me. And I'd heard it so many times while I was making it, and yet it still had that effect on me. So I think there's a level of they're really all-consuming, these stories, when you listen to them. I feel like you could believe that you were actually there, and therefore you have the effects of it.
And the adjective I'd actually use is immersive. It's a wonderful immersive experience that you've put together. As we said, title is Prelude. It's based on a short story by David Tully, originally scripted as a teaser for the full cast Blake 7 adventure of The Mark of Cain. Alan, is this a case of, again, the excitement and the immersive nature of the experience is something which you're also keen to see developed? And have you heard from David Tully? Is he happy with the final product?
Well, the interesting thing about David Tully was he's written two more stories in the last few weeks. Both of them are extremely good. The latest one he's written is called The Next Life, and I think that one's going to go out at Christmas because it's actually... It's almost a direct follow-on from what happens in Premature Burial. So you're like that, Alex. And it's quite, again, it's a bit of a spooky, ghosty, horror story. So, but the other one we had was called There's No Point in Asking. And that's there was not arguments, but discussions over certain things I wanted to change or he wanted to keep or whatever. And then Prelude came out, and he listened to it and got back and said, no, forget it, this is brilliant. Carry on, do what you want to do. So he's good like that, actually. Everyone needs editing sometimes. And he's not too precious about it. I mean, there are some people you can work with who won't have a single word changed, even though what they've written isn't particularly good. So it's certainly not the case with David Tully. David Tully's a superb writer, I think.
Interesting, and it seems a bit unusual to be talking about artwork on a predominantly audio radio medium, but I noticed that the illustrations to accompany the actual piece were put together by Timothy Stephen Keeble, and he seems to, again, sort of captured a kind of 21st century take on Blake 7 quite effectively. I mean, Chrissy, were you impressed with the artwork?
I love the artwork. I love the fact that we get a postcard with each one of these. It's wonderful. I never thought that we would be able to get that as well. I mean, it just didn't occur to me, you know, but they're really lovely mementos to go with the stories themselves. Really wonderful, wonderful work.
Was that something you'd intended to put into place, Alan, as added value, added bonuses for the subscribers and so on?
I think it sort of developed originally. I think the first two or three stories, Chrissy and I did the artwork. We take a screen grab from the TV show, and then Chrissy would run it through various processes and really kind of make it look like 35mm film. And then there were a few other processes you can, you know, give sort of like artwork effects or whatever. But Timothy had worked with me on doing some postcards, Doctor Who postcards, for the Celestial Toy Room magazine. And I can't remember how I came about the idea now. I suddenly had the idea. I think it was because Gothic, that the character in that one was a mutoid, which hadn't appeared on TV. It was one that I'd, I created with David Tully, and so we needed her represented in the picture. And so I thought, well, it'll have to be original artwork. And so I got back to Tim about it, and he'd agreed to do it, and he did it. And then I was talking to Paul Winter, who'd been responsible for the postcards, which had been done for the CT, and I suddenly said, could we make these postcards? And he looked into it and saw how much it would cost and how many he could get done. And so, it kind of took off from there. So, I send them out. When people order CDs, I send them free postcards. And there's a convention, which Chris is coming over from Australia, and there's a convention we're going to on the 9th of June, and so we'll probably take the postcards, well, we will take postcards along there and give them away free to the attendees.
Well, you can't just say there's a convention without giving the location of the convention, and assuming what you've just said, Chrissy, coming up from Global South to Global North, where exactly is the convention taking place?
Chrissy, do you know where is the convention?
The question. Hello? The question for Chrissy Pashley. She's still there. I'm not sure whether she actually heard that particular question. Chrissy, where is the convention actually taking place? And she's lost sound completely. Oh, she's trying to fix this. It's like a Blake 7 episode. It's just so exciting on that side of things. There, it's all working very well. But never mind. Let's move on to the next.
Sound
question.
Design has lost the sound.
There is an irony in that. There is an irony, but there's nothing that we've pressed on our particular end, so maybe it's a case of perhaps sort of log back in again. I don't know. It's a different sort of area. Anyway, all we can
always, you see her on the screen?
I can see her on the screen looking bemused, I think it's
frantically
fair to say.
Trying to stick.
I can hear you.
Welcome back.
Yes. Yeah. The question was, Chrissy, which clearly you couldn't either lip read because you can't see us. Basically, where is the convention taking place?
Oh, the convention is on June the 9th in Steventon, which is near Didcot.
There you are, Didcot.
So, near Oxford, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
and that's the, it's called Seek, Locate, Celebrate. And it is a celebration, actually, of Stephen Greif, who died in December 2023. So
absolutely, and of course tying in with Travis as well, and the classic episode of not the same name, of course, because there was no Celebrate in the original title. I think that would have been too dark for the whole thing.
Seek, Locate, Destroy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
That was a bit of a shock, Stephen Greif dying, wasn't it? I mean, he was he did squash, and he was always looked very fit, and suddenly just disappeared. You know, what the hell was that noise?
Don't worry, it's okay. It's another system entirely. This is Women in Horror Month. Earlier in this particular hour, we were speaking to a couple of American horror writers, Kelly Florence and Meg Halfdahl. Chrissy, a question for yourself: if we were to define Blake 7 as a genre, does it cross over between horror and science fiction, or would you see it as purely science fiction, or would you actually give it another title or avoid any label whatsoever?
I would call it science fiction. Actually, because there's been some suggestion over time that it might be some of the actors have made comments over time in interviews saying, oh, it felt like it was heading into fantasy. And I could see why you would say that, but I don't think it ever did, not really. So there were no sort of monsters and things like that. I feel like it's pure science fiction. It's stories about people in a science context.
Yeah. I mean, Alan?
I slightly disagree with that. I would say, because Chris Boucher said he liked to cross genres. So there was a science fiction show, but also had elements of the Western in it. In fact, he used to put in lines from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and The Wild Bunch and all these classic Westerns of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And so there was a kind of a Western element to it. I think there was a fantasy element to some episodes. I think Sarcophagus had a fantasy element to it. I think there was occasional, though mild, horror, because, of course, it was a family show that went out at about 7. You can't be too explicit. But I think there was a kind of mixture of genres. So, yeah, I mean, I think Rescue is a horror story, isn't it? But this guy's got this monster in a basement, which is also somehow, connected to him, like a sort of Dorian Gray thing. So there is a horror element to it.
Perhaps the ultimate thing is they're just good stories, and maybe we get too hung up in generic terms, because I do know lots of debate over the years between, as Chrissy's just said, what's fantasy, what's science fiction, what's horror. There is a kind of advertisement in terms of how they all interconnect together. Okay, Gothic, Travis, The Final Line, You Fly, You Die, Premature Burial, and of course Prelude. What's next, Alan?
The next one, Chrissy's working on at the moment. It's called Scars. I think was it co-written by me and David Tully? Chrissy, I can't remember. She's gone again. Oh no, go on.
Both of you, I think.
Both of us, is it? I can't remember. It was a long time ago when it was written. I think it was written about 25 years ago. But it was this is a pretty tough story, actually. Might have to put a bit of a warning on this one. But the interesting thing is it stars Blake. And, of course, Gareth Thomas passed away a few years back.
Yeah, Blake.
And we've recast him with Robert Locke. And the interesting... Well, Robert Berenger Locke, better get his name right. The reason why is actually... partly down to you, Alex, because some years back you listened to an audio production I'd done with Paul Darrow, Trevor Cooper, and Robert Berenger Locke, called what was it called, Chrissy? I can't remember the title of it. The Time Waster, wasn't it? That was right. And you said, "Oh, you've got Gareth Thomas in it," and I said, "No, that's Robert Berenger Locke." But that suddenly stuck in my head, and I thought, actually, there is a lot of similarity between him. So when I was directing him, there were certain lines and certain words I was directing him towards. This is how, like, there's in Blake, for example, Gareth Thomas says, "Why don't you sit down, Tarrant?" And there's a bit of Welsh there coming through. And so I had, because Tarrant is mentioned in the story, he says Tarrant. And anyway, we recorded it. And Alastair Locke also plays another actor, sadly passed, was called Jeremy Wilkin, and he had played Dev Tarrant. Was it Dev Tarrant, Chris? Yeah, I think
she's nodding. She's nodding. That's okay. Yeah. It's good radio technique. Not talking over each other, but actually nodding. So that's good.
Yeah, good. They performed together, and we recorded it. I directed it, and she's putting it together at the moment. And I said, "Well, how does it sound?" He said, "He's uncanny. He's just like Gareth." And I said, "I thought he would be." And of course, Chrissy is a huge fan of Gareth Thomas. She's not just from Blake 7, she's got all his videos from various Play for Today.
Okay,
and
Chrissy, I've got to ask the question, Gareth Thomas in London's Burning or Gareth Thomas in Blake 7, where would you actually go, Blake 7 or London's Burning?
Blake 7.
Wow, there you go. That's okay. Even though London's Burning also starred one of our other favourite actors, Rupert Baker, but never mind, that's all good. Okay, how can people get hold of the stories so far, and indeed Prelude, which is what we've been discussing today? Alan?
They're all available for free to download on the Caldor City website, www.caldorcity.com. Just go there and you go to the news page, and it's there. You just download it and listen. They're only short stories. Some of them are about 4 minutes long. I think this Prelude is about 9 minutes long. However, there is a new one we're working on, or have finished actually, and that will be coming out in September, which is about 18 minutes long. So that's the longest we've done so far. Mm-hmm. But Scars will be coming out in June, I think. Isn't that right, Chrissy?
About 15 minutes. That's what you said.
15 minutes in June will be fine. We got the message, basically. It's like one of those old Too Runny sketches where you say, what? Pardon? It's great. It is Australia. We're all connecting all that sort of things. Chrissy, it's been awesome connecting with you, good self, as ever. Probably one of the most challenging Zoom ones we've actually had for quite a while. I blame the Gloucester link, but never mind.
Well, I can't, the thing is, you keep saying that, Alan, you should get Zoom, but yes. I'm the person you can hear.
Okay.
I'm really sorry that I can barely hear you, and that's why I'm...
Chrissy, it's been a delight as ever. Take care. Is this going to be your first trip to the UK, or have you been up here before for the convention?
Oh, I used to live in the UK.
So
I did come for a convention... Yeah. Like 2 years ago, so
Oh, well, there you go. That's all right, because obviously all sorts of things going from global south to global north, which we could go into, but there we go.
Yeah, Chrissy was originally born in England, and I think she left in 1992 for Australia.
Oh, there you go.
So she's a citizen of Australia, but she's, you know, her roots are here.
So there we are. And CaldorCity.com, the place to go to, Alan, as ever?
Absolutely. Go there now. Listen.
Sound designer Chrissy Pashley and co-founder of Magic Bullet Productions and huge Blake Seven scholar and aficionado, Alan Stevens, huge thanks. And keep on keeping on, both.
Great. Bye-bye, then.
Metal door, metal wall, metal bunk. He lay on the bunk and stared at the metal ceiling, remembering. It was a barren hall. Federat Industrial 00967586. It had a name once, but names were something they dug up for the obituaries. Ash, clinker, slag, more slag, and the ever-present dust that slaked water to mud. To the west, a glow in the sky as the autoblasts rained down on the city. There might have been the sound of screaming, but that was part of his mental furniture. He was so used to it, he barely heard it anymore. He stood on an outcrop that commanded a view of the valley. Most of the buildings down there were on fire now. He rubbed a line of dust from the edge of his eye patch with a black-gloved hand. On one finger, a large, uncut gem held fire inside. There was no held fire down in the valley. The dull, wet crash of Federation sidearms, the occasional shot ricocheting, wowing from wall to wall, empty street to empty street. He remembered a piece of graph as they'd first arrived, crudely scrawled on the corrugate of a standard Fed sleep cell.
"Federation, go home," it said. "We don't want to be helped any more."
His men had caught the young girl who'd done it. A part of his mind acknowledged the memory of her face as they'd killed her in front of her family. Then, the family. It meant nothing. The reports had filtered in, gradually. Something strange was happening. Unconfirmed accounts, growing panic, a feeling that things were getting out of control. Then, one by one, the outposts went silent. At first, he thought it was just another symptom of rebellion. But there was more to it than that. A quite definite pattern was emerging. Then, he'd been alone, walking the dark streets of the blasted town. Most of the inhabitants were held in detention, behind razor wire, shrinking back from the sleek snarls of the Fed masks, the obscene gun snouts, in detention, but alive. Then, right on the outskirts of an old colony shipyard, he'd seen the shadowy figure flitting from disabled ship to disabled ship. He'd ghosted after it, and eventually found himself standing on a flight deck. He'd paused in the half-dark, intent, sure he'd heard a sound. Almost without thinking, he'd pulled the cowling from a nearby control panel, looking it over with a practiced eye. There was something not quite right here. Although the setup was standard colony issue, there had been adaptations, changes. He'd followed them to source, and that was when he'd found it. Something quite different in design. Something with a power supply, all of its own. A transmitter of some kind. Ident on a loop. Code pattern in a nightmare of circuitry. He couldn't be sure, but he thought it was on standby, waiting for orders. He'd taken the memory crystal, and the setup had died, melted to nothing. Just the crystal left, hard in his hand. And, in one facet of the crystal, a movement, behind him. He'd whirled, pointed, fired, all at once. The man had died, blowing a hole in the deck plates. And then... remembering it, he still couldn't believe it. He'd put the crystal inside his tunic and got out of there. He was back in the stockade before full light. In the shadows, the eyes of the people inside were like small stars. He'd watched them for a moment before he gave the order to open fire. Now he was on his hilltop, watching the mopping up operation.
"Kill everyone!"
he'd said, and that's just what they were doing. His orders, their shooting. They were good at it. Murderously efficient, you might have said. He watched the boy run out of the town, up the hillside towards him. He raised his gun hand lazily and waited. There was no fear in the boy's eyes. It was like killing a snake. And then, the body separated and split, dissolved into a greenish, steaming mass. Alien, just like the man before. He touched the shape of the cold crystal concealed in his pocket. Maybe the answer was there, somewhere. Movement. He tensed, then relaxed. It was Parr. The man was sweating, streaked with dirt and gore. He regarded the mess on the ground.
"Blazing hell,"
he opined.
"The city is a blazing hell. As for what this is... do you have something to say to me, trooper?"
"Assignment completed, as ordered, sir."
"Very well."
"And you are to place yourself under close arrest, pending court-martial proceedings and the attendance of the circuit arbiter for this sector." "I'm sorry, sir. The order just came in."
He nodded, grimly.
"Then carry out the order."
"Sir?"
"What?"
"The report, sir."
Travis smiled.
"No one would believe it."
They walked down to the burning town together. Now, the cell. Metal walls. Waiting. He smiled again, conscious of the irony. It wasn't every day you stumbled across an alien invasion force disguised as humans. He touched the eye patch, eyed his gun hand. Maybe he had a fellow feeling. Sometimes, he felt that he was only disguised as human himself.